I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Friday, and welcome to Food Network Obsessed, the podcast where we dish on all things Food Network with your favorite Food Network stars. I'm your host, Jamie Sire, and today we have Jet Tila on the pod, and I was super excited to have him on because we sort of have an interesting history with both of us being former floor reporters for the Iron Chef franchise, but he actually surprised me with an even funnier moment that I was totally not aware of until this interview, so I'm excited for you guys to hear it. Also, during our chat, Jet shares some fun Food Network memories, including the story behind his matching tattoos with Alton Brown. Yes, you heard me correctly. We also talk about Jet's family opening the first Thai markets and restaurants in Los Angeles all the way back in the 70s. So he shares some of those memories growing up around food 24/7 and how it really had an impact on him becoming a chef. Of course, we talk about the latest season of Tournament of Champions, but we actually recorded this interview with Jet a couple months ago before the new season premiered, so we didn't have a chance to talk about that crazy tie that happened between him and Antonia at the end of the season. But hey, I guess that just means we'll have to ask Jet back for a part two. So let's get to it, shall we? He is a culinary anthropologist and entrepreneur with appearances on your favorite shows like TOC, Chopped All-Stars, Cutthroat Kitchen, Beat Bobby Flay, and Guy's Grocery Games. I am talking about none other than Jet Tila. Jet, welcome to the pod. How are you doing today?
What's happening, Jamie? It's finally nice to get to, chat, right?
Yes.
We've never had an extended opportunity to kind of get acquainted.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, the only time I've met you in person, we were just standing next to each other at a big Today Show Thanksgiving special. It was super fun for me because it was my first time being on the Today Show. You were repping California. I was repping Montana. They had, people from all 50 states, and we were standing there talking about our dishes and you revealed to me, I hope I'm not outing you because this was actually like a very like positive, interaction that I had, but you told me that you cooked your Thanksgiving dish for the show, like in your hotel room in a microwave via instant cart delivery at like 3 a.m.
Jamie, the first time we're hanging out and you're going right for it, which is a good thing, by the way. I think it's important for people to understand kind of how things happen behind the scenes. So yes, you're correct. My dish was wild rice dressing, and something happened where my associate and friend in New York didn't get it ready for me. So I get off the plane, I get to the hotel, and I Instacart a bunch of wild rice dressings and some accoutrement. I throw it all together in the microwave and I bring it to the Today Show. And that's right. You're exactly right. That's how I got that done that time.
I think we need to out the friend who didn't have the dish. No, I'm just kidding. I would never do that.
Her name is Jamie Sire. That's her name.
That's the friend. Meanwhile, I like special ordered in huckleberries because I thought that I wanted to be very authentic to like Montana, and huckleberries remind me of Montana, and huckleberries are not cheap, by the way. And as it turns out, like this dish that I think I had to bring in two of them, and both of them just sat out, and they didn't. I don't think they took close-ups. There was just a lot of waving and smiling, and I didn't realize that. So I was like trying to, go the extra mile, which was not necessary.
And you did it right. You just did it for the wrong episode. Do you know what I mean?
You
did perfect because the dish was pristine and it was ready to eat and it was like everything you wanted. And then you're like, oh, 50 chefs. 50 dishes. It was one of those giant camera shots that just kind of jibbed all the way through and we just waved and that was it. So next time, don't do it exactly the same way. because that's the way it should
especially,
be.
You know, hopefully next time I'll actually be, you know, demoing the dish and not just, you know, the wave and smile and all that. But we did have a chance to kind of interact a little bit during that 2 hours of just standing out in the cold. we for anybody that doesn't know, we actually have something in common that is unique only to us. So would you like to share with our listeners what that is?
I'm gonna guess that you are speaking of Iron Chef America and floor reporting.
Yes.
Is that right?
That is correct. We are the, obviously Kevin was there for a very long time before us, before the reboots. But you and I are the only ones that have been the floor reporter for exactly one season, just one season.
So how do we read into that, Jamie? I think we need to go deeper, right? What does that mean about us when Kevin had like 15 seasons and we each get one season? So...
All right. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
If I read into it too much, I'll just get depressed. You know what? may I share a story?
Please.
Okay. Because the Today Show was the first time we actually met.
Yes.
We potentially could have met before. So I'm just going to tell you a story about my Jamie Sire story. Because this is what
I love it.
Okay?
I love it.
I'm judging Beat Bobby Flay. All right. And the next ep after me was supposed to be another duo. One of them couldn't make it. It was a some emergency that came up and they're like, we're going to call in Jamie Sire. Somebody was like, oh no, I've never met her, Bobby. And you know, I did the Iron Chef thing after her. I don't know if she's mad at me. Oh. I don't know if, you know, cause we both have reputations on the street for being like we're just normal. We are who we are. We're like nice people. We don't want to make waves. And I was like, I don't know if Jamie hates me, if she's mad at me. And Bobby literally like, dude, Jamie's awesome. She's not going to be mad at you, but like, you know, I'm going to run out the door. So I think you came in one entrance and I jammed out because you were literally right after me. And you know, the turn between shows were really tight. So there's pretty my quick, Jamie Sire story.
That's awesome. I actually do remember that day because I woke up to a text from my agent at like 7 a.m. They're like, can you do Beat Bobby Flay today? And I'm like, yes, like springing out of bed because like I was always jumping at the chance to do that. I always do. I love that show. I had so much fun on that show. And I do remember getting to studio and I knew that you were there. I had no idea that I was actually supposed to host with you potentially. And that it was a little switcheroo situation. For the record, I do not hate you. I was not mad at you ever. I know that like there's business decisions that are over our heads, over 1,000%. Our pay grade.
1,000%. Yeah. So, way above us and for good or bad reasons. But I didn't know. And I was just like, you know what I mean? But we both were kind of, I think I was in the same headspace, right?
I think I was like, when I heard you were there, I was like, oh God, I hope you don't run into each. I didn't want to run into you only because I'm incredibly awkward in those situations.
As am I, by the way, as am I.
So it was nothing to do with you. It was only to avoid any awkwardness. So maybe someday we can talk to Bobby and have him put us on as co-hosts and we can redo the moment that was supposed to happen.
The circle will be complete. Because now we're homies and we know we've done. I just thought I'd share because this is a great podcast you're doing, by the way. And I thought,
thank you.
You know what? This is the kind of content. This is the kind of stuff I want. The stories I want to tell that you don't really get a chance to tell.
No, these are the stories that I love like hearing from people. I think it's so much fun. I think it's great for the viewers and the listeners to kind of, you know, get that little inside look of what happens on TV in certain situations. But I'm so glad you told that story. That's such a great story.
Anyway, but I'm glad we're friends now. So
yes, you know, it's absolutely. All good. I am very glad for that as well. But speaking of Iron Chef, though, I mean, that must have been a cool experience for you just because you had been on the show previously as a competitor. And now, you know, the kind of the tables have turned and you're there now, the one interviewing all these chefs.
Yeah. You know, I think Iron Chef really sums up kind of my Food Network journey because it was about 10 years in between, you know, becoming a full-time chef. Well, I was a full-time chef for like 20 something years.
Right.
I was asked to do Iron Chef while I was in Las Vegas, cooking at this really, you know, big deal hotel. And then to like my journey as a chef ended kind of when I taped Iron Chef because, you know, I met Allie, wanted to get married, have kids. And then, so my media career began at that point. So about a decade later, I'm back in, you know, this kitchen stadium as the floor reporter. So it was very surreal. It was an amazing experience. And, you know, and it's, I think, you know, I mean, like we were talking about, it's, you gotta know when to jump in, and you gotta know when to like approach the chefs. I think what the one of the advantages for me was knowing, like, and cooking along with some of the our Iron Chefs and other competitors. So yeah, I'll never forget it, man. You know, it was really great.
No, I agree. I had such a great experience on the show. We both wish it was a longer experience, but that's
one season. Yeah, exactly.
Well, speaking of competition shows, we obviously have to talk about Tournament of Champions. It's definitely a show on everyone's minds right now. We saw you on the show last season. You were eventually knocked out by Brooke Williamson, who, of course, went on to win the entire thing. And this season you are back.
Yep.
So coming back, do you feel like you have something to prove, perhaps?
Man. OK, this is your show, and it's a good chance for me to have therapy at the same time and talk about
the truth. I love it. I'll be your therapist.
Please, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Yeah. Tournament of Champions for me is really the show I want to win the most.
Right? Really?
Truly. Because, you know, I'm not a super competitive guy, right? Especially when it comes to competing against friends, right? In the world, when I was a chef, very competitive, very aggressive, but it's like, oh, I know all these people, and I am a different person on Tournament of Champions. Like when you have a stadium like that, and when you have blind judging, and when you have that caliber of competitors plus judges, it's like, I don't want to mess up, because I don't want to give anyone in this room license to be like, oh, that dude brought it halfway and he's not going to bang heads.
What did you learn from last season that you are bringing to the competition this year?
For me, I'm an overthinker, right? The problem that I have is when I walk into a competition situation, I'm overthinking every little step. What I really learned this year was let the randomizer do its thing and then just flow with it. Last year, I was like trying to will the randomizer. I was trying to use the force. I was trying to
use the force.
Yeah, I was trying to use ESP, and none of it worked. So this year, I just went with it. I no idea what was going to come. I cooked a lot too, by the way. I mean, good or bad, I think this last year we all did a lot of cooking.
Yes.
And I was watching your content. You were cooking, man.
Thank you. No, yes, I was cooking
time.
A lot. Yes.
Yeah. And for me, I was doing the same thing, because I think a lot of not being a traditional restaurant chef anymore, kind of running different aspects of our organization, you get a little out of touch. And it was really nice to spend like a good 6-7 months cooking, walking into Tournament of Champions.
Yeah. I mean, I want to know more about the randomizer, because that seems like just a scary, like, few seconds as you're like watching. And for anyone who hasn't seen the show last year or haven't had a chance to watch yet this season, I mean, basically, you know, it's this big wheel, kind of like a Wheel of Fortune situation, but like five of them. And there's like a proteins and veggies and tools you have to use and time. And it just like goes around and you're just waiting for it to land. Like which of those things on there just like really makes you nervous, makes you sweat? Like that's the one thing that you absolutely do not want it to land on.
Chefs, I think we all have Achilles heels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that thing is basically just loaded with five different reels of Achilles heels. And I went out last year I went out last year in Middle Eastern. And, I cook a lot, but, you know, I was always scared of, you know, cultures that I just haven't cooked a lot of. And I was always scared of like tools, you know, like crazy tools. Like, I mean, I've used waffle makers to make waffles, but there's also a lot of crazy things on there that I think it really changed the fate of each cook. So there was I don't think anyone ever had like a give me, and it just gets harder as the game progresses.
Yeah. I mean, it's a randomizer, but it's also kind of like this, I guess, equalizer.
Yes.
Everyone's just kind of now on the same page. I think I was trying to think like what would make me like really nervous. And
yeah,
I don't
give
know
me your like Achilles heels or like things that would make you like scared to have to do either.
Well, here's the thing. I, and people who listen to the podcast know or follow me on social media, I'm very vocal about the fact that I hate bell peppers. I don't even know if bell peppers is on the veggie list but it could be because I hate them so much and I don't know what to do with them. And I, you know, like I just, and I wouldn't be able to taste the dish and know that it is balanced, whatever, because all I'd be able to taste is the bell pepper. So I think for me, that would be really hard, but there's so many things on there that would be just like so mind blowingly like difficult that I can't.
Yeah. I mean, like one I didn't get was like a raclette. Like you know what I mean? Like,
oh, like the actual
burner, like the melter, like the raclette melter. And I'm sure you're not using it to make raclettes. You know what I mean? So like, what do you do? So there were a lot of really, kind of crazy, you know, combinations, but you still got to cook your way through it. And the level of competition this year, the level of like the stakes are higher because you kind of, even although you know what's going to go down, you're looking at 15 other of some of the best chefs, you know, in the world or in America. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's what fires you up when you look around. It's a lot like MMA. I mean, it feels like that. You know what I mean?
I mean, is there anyone you were excited or maybe terrified to see this season?
Yeah. You know, Brooke, obviously, because she's legitly like talented and like plays it close to the vest and doesn't really give you much to work with, plays the mind games in a smart way. And Tony is always like freaking me out. So, you know, all right, I'm going to get in trouble, but I'm just going to say like, I think the West Coast bracket is like a dangerous bracket. I mean, East Coast is like awesome, but you know, to fight your way through the West Coast bracket is scary. And I've just made 8 enemies saying that.
Yeah, you just threw down the gauntlet on East, you know, East versus West. But I mean, that's what this competition is about. And as you mentioned, you know, it does have the sports feel to it. And obviously athletes can be very, very superstitious. I'm wondering if you have any like rituals, any superstitions before you kind of step out onto the stage that you do to kind of get ready.
Yeah. So I had a good luck charm each season. So last season was, you know, out of a bunch of Navy SEAL buddies, you know, old school, real deal guys. And, you know, they gave me a challenge coin before I competed and were like, this is a good luck charm. So this year I wore a lucky watch from a good friend of mine. It's like nothing fancy, but it was just symbolic. You know what I mean? So I had my red watch because, you know, Chinese red's a lucky number and, you know, in my culture. And so that was really it. So I didn't do anything extreme, like not shower or not shave. Or, you
well,
know.
I'm sure people were thankful for that portion of it.
And I don't, you know, and I don't have the ability as a man to get that big old crazy playoffs
like
facial.
Like a hockey
yes,
beard.
Exactly. Yeah. I won't look like a Viking. I'll look more like Fu Manchu. So it would be the opposite of intimidating.
Okay. I like the lucky charms. I think those are a nice addition and something that you can kind of keep with you and know that it's there. I also love the charity component this year because not only are you playing for the title, you're playing for a local restaurant, which as we know throughout this pandemic, they have been hit so incredibly hard. How much extra motivation did that give you to you know, cook even harder and really compete,
man, like
for them?
Guy and Food Network, every win was a considerable amount of money to, you know, the winners at a local restaurant. And, you know, that really was kind of that warm and fuzzy, that thing that, you know, was the extra fire, in my opinion. And a lot of money was raised by everybody for the restaurants. And on top of that, getting your restaurant mentioned, right, you know, in front of millions of people, right, in that genuine moment of paying homage to that restaurant is so beneficial. I mean, coming from a mom and pop restaurant family, like that was the icing on the cake for this season.
Up next, Jet talks about having Alton Brown as a mentor during his time as a judge on Cutthroat Kitchen. Plus, he tells the story behind their matching tattoos.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
You are no stranger to these competition shows. You've competed against, you know, as we mentioned, against Morimoto on Iron Chef. You've also competed and won Guy's Grocery Games. You judged arguably the most evil show of all time, Cutthroat Kitchen, for many years. What do you have any favorite memories or stories from any of these shows that you can share with us?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think Cutthroat Kitchen was really where, you know, no pun, like I cut my teeth, right? Like, so I think the first memory of kind of being like that full-time Food Network job was getting that call, you know, as a fledgling young, you know, person on Food Network and going, oh, you're going to be able to, you know, work with Alton Brown every single day on this one show. And, you know, I don't think people really ever knew. So, you know, Alton and I are very, very good friends. In fact, we have matching tattoos. And yes, that all came from those hours and hours and hours on Cutthroat Kitchen. So what, and I told Alton early on, I was like, I really want to get good at this TV thing because, you know, it's totally different muscles. It takes a lot of different skills. And can you help me? So he would actually make time after every episode and was like, look, this is, you got a less ums here, get to the point here. You know what I mean? This is the way. So, you know, having like that one-on-one time with Alton was brilliant. And then as the years went on, that happened with Bobby and that happened with Guy. It's such a warm kind of family that we have. And mm-hmm. to be able to have that kind of very genuine, like, yo, dude, you really want to get good? Then, you know, don't do this and do this. And everyone kind of helps each other. So from being a fan to kind of being able to hang out with, and you know, I still get like little chills and like I'll pinch myself when, oh, Bobby Flay just texted me, we're gonna go eat dinner together, yada yada. So yeah, Jamie, I'll always be that, like that kid who grew up watching Food Network as a chef, and just to have these opportunities to speak with you, to hang out in the groups when we're all in South Beach, it just trips me out, man. I mean, it really, I feel very fortunate to be able to have this opportunity.
No, I love that. I feel the exact same way. And I love hearing that, you know, Alton, you started off as a mentor, obviously became, you know, a very close friend of yours. I need to know more about the tattoos. I remember when it happened, but I forget what is the tattoo that you guys have, that you both have?
So my right forearm, his left inner arm, it is a quote that says, never be daunted. And what we were like, you know, hanging out, we're like, we should get matching tattoos. And like, what do you want? And he's like, oh, I want this quote. And he's like, what do you want? I was like, oh, that's way smarter than what I wanted. maybe I shouldn't say, but what I wanted was like,
no, what did you want?
Okay. I mean, again, this is the place to drop all kinds of stuff.
It's a safe place.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Thousands and thousands of people listening. Anyway. Okay. Why not? I wanted a little chef octopus, 8 legs with each one having a different little utensil.
So I love it.
It's cheese ball. Let's just be real.
It's still cool. I like it. I like it. I mean, the never be daunted is definitely more powerful for sure.
Way more.
Especially since you guys got the same one and your friendship, as you just described it, I think it's really, really cool.
Typewriter font. Cause you know, he's smart like that and has typewriters. Exactly. So now I just use his story and say, oh yeah, you know, It's Hemingway. Doesn't everyone read Hemingway?
You've just adopted it for yourself, which I love. I mean, you obviously have a lot of tattoos. I know you were featured in Ink magazine also.
Oh man, you did all your digging. That's amazing. Yeah,
I gotta research. I gotta dig in.
Wow.
But I'm wondering, I want you to tell the story. I know it because I read the article, but your first tattoo and what the meaning behind that is.
Are you talking about the brand tattoo when I was 18?
Yes.
Oh, yes. No. Okay. When we're 18, we all think we're cool. And my buddies are like, dude, let's get the Sing logo from the Thai beer on our arms. Because, you know, I was born the year of the tiger. So in my mind, I rationalized it like, oh, I'm a tiger. I'm going to get a tiger. That sounds really, really tough and cool. You know, cut to like 2-3 years later and I'm walking around Thailand and my dad's like, you're an idiot. You just got like a brand. You just got a brand logo on your arm and you're not even getting paid for it. Yeah, it's like getting Budweiser or something.
Yeah.
Or Coors, which would be awesome. Anyway, would have been cooler than that. So yes, I will always love hate my tiger tattoo on my right arm.
So that's a love hate. What's your actual like favorite one?
Last year I put this one on my right wrist, which is the name. I've got Allie, Amaya, and Ren. Yeah, so my wife and two children on my forearm here, and that's the one I love the most. That's the one I love the most.
Well, no, that means the most. I do not have any. I'm planning. I want to get one in honor of my father. Actually, I haven't had a chance to do it yet because of the pandemic. But it's on my. But I like to hear people's stories of their tattoos and why they've gotten them and you know even the stories where you maybe wish you could go back and change it. So
I'm gonna flip. Can I ask you a question? I know this is your show, please. But being around so many chefs and food people, do you get a little bit of that? Yo, I got to get a tattoo. Like there's a little bit of this camaraderie, this fellowship that we have.
I mean, definitely a lot of, I would say more chefs than not have not even one, like more than one. So I do see like how you could kind of get caught up in that. But I was always like told I wasn't allowed to have tattoos or anything like that. So it's like been ingrained into my head for so long. But I think I'm ready. I think I really want to do that. I think it's for me, you know, it'll mean something to me. And I think that's super an important part of it as well. Not always the most important, but in my case it will be. So
no, that's,
I appreciate
cool.
you playing along and telling those stories, because I love hearing that.
Yeah, I think they're fun. I think tattoos, you know what, they do a phenomenal job at you know, being a bookmark in time and homage to your father. I mean, that's the perfect kind. And that's why my favorite tattoo is the one that's most symbolic of my family. All these, I mean, I have some jackass tattoos and I've got some serious tattoos, but that's just what happens, man. You'll get sucked in, you know?
Oh, I'm sure I will. I'm sure it won't be my last one.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. Well, we kind of touched on this a little bit. On TOC, you're repping for the West Coast. Obviously, you grew up in Los Angeles. You were born into essentially the first family of Thai food in LA. Your family opened, you know, the first Thai restaurants, the first Thai markets there. You've referred to it as birth luck. What was your childhood like growing up around food 24/7?
You know, I can romanticize it as a 40-year-old man, right? Mm-hmm. I can romanticize it as a 45-year-old man, but growing up in it, I was truly miserable, right? I mean, imagine if you will, from like literally 5 years old, like the restaurant is your daycare, right? The restaurant is your school, right? And then they opened a grocery store. So it went from restaurant to grocery store. Then they had a produce company. So we'd spend time on farms, right? And then they had an import company. So it was vertical integration before I ever knew what it was. But, you know, looking back on it, you know, I basically had three concurrent apprenticeships in very, very difficult fields. So to work in a restaurant for 10,000 hours and to work in a grocery store and understand products and produce, you know, I did like 20,000 hours by the time I was in my mid-20s. And it was phenomenal. I mean, it really shapes who I am. It really kind of, you know, has directed my culinary point of view. And it really is birth luck. I mean, it's really like being at the right place at the right time. So, you know, I didn't understand it until my mid-20s. But, I was typical, like, you know, kid who becomes a chef. I was, you know, high school dropout, made a lot of trouble. So there was always a home with my family and their businesses. They're always like, if you screw up, you can always come back, but you got to work for it. So it was phenomenal.
I can't see you as being like the troublemaker, like kid.
Oh, that, my plan is working. It is so awesome. You know, and it was, yeah, I wasn't like the guy who was like intimidating or anything. I was just a rebel, right? Mm-hmm. I never wanted to do what people told me. I was in my mind thought I was going to do it my own way. I hate going to school. I'm not going to learn any books. You're not going to teach me anything. And so, yeah, I've been working, I mean, man, since I was a kid. So I was never like a bully or anything like that. I was just a guy that was, there's a word for it, oppositional defiance disorder. I think my wife has a master's in early childhood education, treats me like a child. So I think that's just part of diagnosing.
So it works
children.
Out.
It works out perfect.
One of your family's businesses, Bangkok Market, closed in 2019 after nearly 50 years in business. So I'm curious, you're talking about, you know, growing up there and not liking it at the time. But as you look back, like, what is your most vivid memory or vivid smell or something that immediately like takes you back to that time when you see it or eat it or smell it or anything like that?
That truly is the smell of my childhood. It takes me immediately back to being a kid, you know, stocking shelves and, you know, working in the butcher counter and tying produce and being in the farms. But, you know, the really great memories are this. I mean, we were the only grocery store in the 80s and 90s that had, quote unquote, exotic ingredients. So Wolfgang and Joachim and you know, Susan and Mary Sue, all the great chefs in L.A. shopped at our store. And as I got older, I wasn't just bagging the groceries. I was delivering their groceries and I was setting up their, you know, their order guides. And when I went to French culinary school, I went back and I was like, you guys all know me from bagging your groceries. Can I have a job now? So I got to, you know, work in the Asian restaurants as a kid. And once I went to culinary school, I got to go back and work for some of these really great chefs that were just kind of patrons of the store. So it really worked out.
That's so cool. Like, I love hearing that it kind of came full circle for you. If you were one of those chefs shopping in those aisles, what makes its way to your shopping cart or basket like every single time? Like, what are some of those staples that you would always pick up?
Yeah, you know, I am, you know, as everyone knows, my lens is very Southeast Asian. So it's always going to be like fish sauce and jasmine rice and curry paste and coconut milk and, you know, like seven different kinds of soy sauces. You know, that's definitely my part of the world. And, you know, it'll always kind of be where I'm from. It's part of my identity.
I mean, speaking of that, I mean, you talk about just, you know, these influences in your life and other significant Asian influences as well, you know, aside from Thai, you've got Chinese, Korean, Japanese influences, and those really all present themselves, I feel like, in the dishes that you create. What does it mean to you to be able to represent Asian food culture in such a significant way and a diverse way?
Yeah, you know, it really, you know, you hear it, but it's an honor. I mean, it's an honor to be able to represent multiple cultures. And it's also an honor to kind of share knowledge. My favorite job in the whole world is teaching, right? If I could just like do that every single day, I'd be very happy there. So when I get emails every day and DMs about, yo, you just taught me how to make lo mein, and you just taught, and lo mein eventually becomes pad thai, and pad thai becomes curry, and now they're doing sushi, and, you know, through Food Network and through writing cookbooks and working, you know, I get to teach the world how to make Asian food. And my whole thing is, it's easier than you think. You know what I mean? And so that is the fuel. It really is the fuel. I mean, you know, the happiest things in my life are my family. And the second part of it is to be able to teach and create community all at the same time. And this is the platform in which I can do that. It's a dream job. I don't work there's not a single day of work. I get to just kind of do what I love every single day. It's pretty amazing.
No, that community aspect is, I think, really important. And the way that food can really create that, I think, is super special. And in fact, I know you kind of helped a retirement community celebrate fully being vaccinated, the entire facility vaccinated. What was that celebration like? What did it entail, and how did you get kind of hooked in with that?
Where'd you get all this amazing research? It's like, this is the stuff I keep off my social media and my whole thing. Like, this is, that's amazing, Jamie. Okay. Yeah. So, part of my working life through the years is, working with very large institutions, right? From tech companies to hospitals to movie studios, but also it's very important to me to kind of work with senior living centers. So for the last decade, no one knows this until now, I would visit and cook and do demos and make menus at a lot of senior living centers. So all the senior living centers in the world were impacted first from COVID. And it was a big push to try to get everybody, you know, vaxxed first. And then what goes with that are the food service workers and all the, you know, also other support staff. So, you know, we got everybody vaxxed. We got all the support staff vaxxed. So to kind of celebrate, I did, this little virtual hangout saying, hey guys, let's make a dish together. I miss you guys. I can't wait to come back. And it was a fun little deal we did a few weeks ago.
I think that is really, that's really sweet. And that's really admirable that you do take that time to kind of, you know, spread that joy and give back. And I think more people should know about it. So I wanted to give you credit for that.
I'm always giving back to, you know, young kids that come from poverty who want to cook, senior living centers, because like history repeats itself. And what better way to understand what's coming down the pipe than to hang out with people who've lived it. You know, I've hung out with people who are 104, you know what I mean? 100 years old. And, you know, and it's amazing to be able to have that opportunity. And I also do a lot with the military and my brother's a police officer. So wherever I can, I'm always trying to give back, because you got to keep that karma bank full, man, you know, because you never know when, you know, you're going to need help. And, you know, it's nice to know that to put a lot of positive energy on the world, it will come back. It absolutely will.
No, I think that's a great message. And I think it says a lot that, you know, I mean, I think it would be obviously great and fine if you were publicizing this stuff, but you clearly aren't doing it for the publicity or the like me over here saying good job, because I do think that and I feel that, but like you're clearly doing it because that's important to you. And that's something that like you don't even think twice about it. Like that's like a yes, like I'm going to do that.
My family came from nothing. I mean, literally in one generation, we came from an ultra poor family and to make something of ourselves. And in two generations to be able to be this immigrant son, to be on, you know, Food Network, it's, you know, every day is a privilege. And every day, if I can pass it forward or pay it back somewhere, you know, that's my aim in life. It really is, you know, makes me happy.
No, I think that's great. Is that something, I mean, what does your family think? I mean, you say that you came from nothing and then now you are on Food Network and you're in a position to be able to give back. What do they think of all this?
You know, they're the foundation. You know what I mean? They remind me where I come from. You know, I have a group of, you know, my family constantly, you know, your feet are always on the ground in our house. You know what I'm saying? So it's all good.
Well, I had so many more questions that I wanted to ask you, but we are running a tad short on time. So I'm going to leave you with our standard final question that I like to ask all of our guests here on Food Network Obsessed. And that is, what would be your perfect food day? So breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert. There are no rules in this question. So you can time travel. You can cook the food. Somebody else can cook it. You can go to multiple countries. Lay it out. What's your perfect food day?
My perfect food day would probably start in France, eating pastries with my wife and kids. That would definitely, because I just
want specific
to eat.
Pastry or just any of
you know
them?
Again, just any like a, you know, good baguette and French butter, and then go immediately to laminated doughs. I mean, just do that 5,000 calorie breakfast. Remember, no rules.
There's no
right?
rules. Like, there's no rules. There's no there's no consequences. There's no rules.
Okay, and then teleport for lunch to Japan. Right, and have, you know, a really nice, like some, like an omakase, like, you know, sushi lunch somewhere. And then dinner would be, you know, teleporting back in time to hang out with my grandmother from my mother's side. So she was my first culinary teacher. I had some special needs issues as a child, and it was very hard for me to focus. So she directed all that crazy energy into the kitchen. So from age three, she would stand me next to her, and it was having to work with my hands, understanding how my brain processed things kind of different. She taught me how to cook from like age 3 to age 12. And we've spent thousands of meals together. And she didn't live long enough to see any of this. Aww. Hang out with Jamie Sire or Bobby. She didn't see any of that. So it would be to bring her back. And we'd all have lunch together or somewhere on like, it would be like Sobe, where there would be all of us all hanging out together. Yeah. And just giving, making her the star of the day and breaking bread for dinner with her. That would be my perfect food day.
I love that. I love that. Wait, what's for dessert? What's for dessert?
Oh, dessert. Wow, that's a good one. You know, it would probably be having to do like a dessert crawl.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But you know, I do favor savory food more than sweet. So I just might do a second course of teleporting back to Japan and having some kind of like giant, you know, Kobe meal or something like that. It would be crazy.
Yeah. I'm on board for that answer because I am also not a huge sweets person. And yeah, I would much more rather like just have more savory right? foods. Yeah. So I like the ending to your food day. Just more delicious, fatty
just
food.
More food, yeah. More savory, fatty food and lots of red wine. Right.
I mean, yes. Like,
that's the, oh, or maybe Spain, maybe finish finish in Spain. I think that would be the way to go. And I'm purposely not mentioning restaurants because whoever doesn't get mentioned is going to drop an email at me. So there you go.
Well, we'll leave it up to everyone's imagination. I also co-sign on the Spain addition to this perfect food day. It sounds perfect to me. And I do appreciate you taking the time to chat with me and tell all these stories. Some of them I'd never heard before. They were news to me. So no, this is a lot of fun and I really appreciate it.
So I feel the same, Jamie. Your continued success to Judging Bobby Flay together. That'd be awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Always such a delight when I get to chat with an incredible chef who I am so used to watching on Food Network. Everyone's story is so unique. I love hearing all of them. Whether you've been a fan of Jet or this interview made you a new one, you can, of course, binge watch all of Tournament of Champions streaming now on Discovery Plus. As always, thanks so much for listening and make sure you follow us wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single thing. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to rate and review. We love it when you do that. I read them all. That's all for now. We will catch you foodies next Friday.